In your role as CTO, how has it changed what you do day to day? This rise of awareness of foundation models, AI has been around a while, but has it changed things for you?
Yeah, I no longer need to talk to my customers about blockchain.
Well, there's a perk.
Welcome to GeekWire. I'm GeekWire co-founder Todd Bishop, and recently I sat down with Werner Vogels, the Amazon Chief Technology Officer at Amazon headquarters in Seattle. We talked about the evolution of artificial intelligence, the promise of AI in healthcare and the environment, his broader tech predictions for the year, and one of his most iconic traditions at the company's annual cloud conference. It's a fun one. Hope you enjoy.
Dr. Werner Vogels is Chief Technology Officer at Amazon.com, a key figure in the company's approach to cloud computing. His bio describes himself as an engineer, architect, scientist, programmer, troublemaker, executive, revisionist, inventor, mentor, advisor, analyst, academic, sales guy, entrepreneur, data analyst. You probably never heard this read out loud before. System administrator, product owner, evangelist, debater, father, musician, and biker. And it notes that he does not deal well with BS and incompetence, which means that I had better step up my game for this one.
You just asked the question, so I'll answer.
Werner, thanks very much for sitting down with me.
Thank you, Todd. It's my pleasure to actually also support the local media.
Absolutely. So you're here in Seattle this week. Where are you normally in the world?
Well, officially, of course, my office is still here in Seattle, but when I am home is where the heart is, and that's in Amsterdam at the moment. But, you know, I spent actually most of my time on the road still talking to customers, helping them out, trying to understand what are their biggest challenges and how can we at AWS help solve them.
So AI has been around for a long time. And of course, I think you, in fact, even talked about programming expert systems decades ago in Prolog. I mean, you've been doing this for a while. What's been different about the past year or 18 months from your perspective?
Well, I think if you look at all the progressions that we've seen over time that artificial intelligence has made, it's every time when the underlying technology like neural networks or convoluted networks or, you know, other type of networks, how to build these models actually have changed. And what we've seen in the past happening, of course, in the past year to 2 years and probably a little bit longer, is a technology called transformers, which basically makes it very easy to make statistical inferences of how words work together. Yeah. For example, you know, if you talk about a table and in the context there are chairs, then you know it's a physical table. However, if in the context are columns and rows, then it's probably a database table. And so these sort of relationships between words and context is the technology that has driven the ability to consume, take in lots and lots and lots of information and text, and then make relationships between these texts and make it sound like, you know, this text can be generated in context. The cool thing is that what they are also what's called foundational models. Yeah, it's not just large language models. Large language already says it, built on a large body of text. They're also foundational. And foundational means that you can extend them with your private information as a company, for example. Yeah, and you can do that, for example, to help engineers or to, you know, it may be on sort of the unique sales data from your company. You know, here are the 500 proposals we've done to our customers. These were the successful ones. Now I have a customer again in oil and gas. Create for me a proposal that is highly likely to be successful there. Things like that, you know. And so I think there's a lot of these kind of work where we've all become amazed about, yeah. And I think one thing that has really changed, and it has actually maybe not that much to do with the technology itself, is that in the past, AI or similar technologies were business technologies. It were developers that used the technology or business units that used it. What we've seen, because chatbots can easily be built on top of these new large language models, is that it immediately got released to the larger public. And if you look at sort of how adoption trends of the past worked, it would take maybe years before technology went from the lab into the hands of consumers. Yeah, the famous Crossing the Chasm book about sort of, you know, how startups can become successful. So there was this normal sort of cycle where first the lab, the early adopters, then the early majority. Now, suddenly within months, something was released to the general public, which is a very different approach to sort of how people get educated as well. And because in the past, with these longer cycles of adoption, we had an opportunity to educate the general public before they got hands on technology. Now, we've seen this technology getting in the hands of the consumer immediately, who is then amazed because they'd never seen this before. But I still call it, in the early versions, definitely, like a dancing bear. You know, we're all amazed that this bear can dance. We don't really look at whether it dances well or not. Yeah. And I think what we've seen in the past year and a half, 2 years, is that we've seen rapid releases of improving where the bear gets to dance better and better and better. But still, you know, this is still technology that relies on you as an individual actually taking action based on what this technology tells you. It's a tool, you know. Artificial intelligence makes predictions. We, as humans, take actions based on that. And actually, it has nothing to do with sort of the newer, what we call large language models. That's something that's always been the case. If you look, for example, at Amazon, the retailer, we've been using AI-related technologies for past 25 years. Yeah. Recommendations, similarities, all these kind of things that you're used to as a consumer, actually under the covers was AI. But for example, also an area where we have used AI very extensively is in fraud protection. After all, we sit literally on billions and billions of orders, and we know which ones were fraudulent, and you can build a model out of that, that if a new order comes in, it gets a score, a likelihood that this is also a fraudulent order. We then don't decline the order if it meets the bar, but it goes off to a human to investigate. These are still tools for us humans to make decisions on, not automated processes.
So for you, in your role as CTO, how has it changed what you do day to day, this rise of awareness of foundation models? Because as we said, AI has been around a while, but has it changed things for you?
Yeah, I no longer need to talk to my customers about blockchain.
Well, there's a perk.
That actually makes me know. Because, and indeed, I think one of the things that we are going through at the moment is that our customers, remember, AWS is a business-to-business business, not a business-to-consumer.
Right.
Our customers have consumers as their businesses, but AWS themselves really work with large businesses. And so I think every enterprise, whether it's small or large or startups, are all trying to figure out what kind of role can this technology play for me? Where can I get advantages? You know, where are things that, for example, you know, I just came out of Berlin in Germany, and the government there said there's 40,000 open IT positions in Germany alone, which means that, you know, anything that we can improve efficiency, for example, for developers, or we can help developers not needing a four-year education, that actually we're able to contribute already to the tech industry in Germany. So everyone is looking at how can this apply to my particular area. And I think, of course, from an Amazon perspective, we've built these truly as foundational models, yeah, which means that customers come to us, want to take this basic model and then augment it with their unique private secret business data to be able to answer questions from, or to look for particular patterns, or to look for how it can assist them in new decision making. And it's different for each company. In life sciences, it may even be the case that they're looking for new compounds. Yeah, in general, if you look at sort of how in the past, sort of, for example, some cancer drugs are being made, it's basically you have 5 million keys and one keyhole, and you try 5 million times to see whether that fits in there. It's a long-term process. Now, with these kind of technologies, we may be able to speed this up because we can generate more than just only test.
You mentioned software development, and that's one of the things I wanted to ask you about because you were early on this trend. GitHub Copilot and Amazon tools had been released a couple years ago when in your annual predictions, you talked about the real cementing of this trend of the AI-assisted software development. It happened, and now in your 2024 predictions, you point out that this is really going to be cemented even further. Where do you see it going from here?
Well, let me first start off with saying what my predictions were 2 years ago. You know, it was really sort of emulating what a typical developer does if he doesn't know how to write this piece of code. He goes onto Stack Overflow, posts the question, 100 people react, things get upvoted, and he does copy and paste. Yeah. And in essence, the first versions of these kind of developer support tools were copy and paste tools. They would basically tell you, but they would also give an indication, this is coming officially out of the official AWS documentation, not just out of some weird Reddit kind of subreddit somewhere that you copied and pasted from. Because from our perspective, you know, really making sure that we can bring the level of development higher, you know, better security, less bugs and things like that. Those were the early tools that we were building and became pretty successful. But with the ability to understand larger and larger code bases with these large language models, for example, you now can, for example, privately ingest all of Amazon S3 code in there. And it can help a developer start to understand the big patterns in there. If you look at sort of a developer that comes out of, or a young developer that comes out of college or from another, maybe even from another company, it might take 3 to 6 months before they can even become a full-fledged contributing developer because they need to understand the code base. And in the past, a senior developer would be sitting next to you and you would ask the same question over and over again and you could see that he or she would get frustrated. AI doesn't get frustrated. Yeah, and so with a deep insight now into this code base, you can interact with this code base to understand what is it doing and what are the particular patterns. And if I need to add and contribute to this, in what particular style do I need to do this? Plus, you know, and there's lots of things that I think are important. Security, of course, is important, and we can introduce lots of checks there. But also, for example, is this the most cost-effective way to do this, or, and I think equally important, or maybe very important at the moment, is sustainability. Is this the most sustainable way to do this? Yeah, can these tools help us saying, like, maybe you shouldn't send that 5 megabyte picture over because the browser will scale it down anyway. So really minimizing sort of network traffic or just in general resource usage. And these tools can help us there in ways that, you know, we couldn't do before.
When you look at those particular tools going forward, do you see things changing materially in 2024 and the months ahead in terms of how developers are using them and the context and the benefits they get?
Totally. I honestly believe that, you know, first and foremost, not just in Germany, there's a lack of IT personnel. It's a worldwide kind of phenomenon. And at the same time, technology has been evolving exponentially fast. If you come out of a 4-year education out of a college right now, let's say you have a computer science degree, you probably weren't exposed to large language models during your education. So there's a lot of on-the-job training that still needs to happen. And I think that's sort of a shift that is happening where the university 4-year education is much more about critical thinking and learning how to learn, because technology will be a lifelong learning experience for anyone. You know, I've been in this business now for, 30, 40 years. Now, things have changed over time. But the only way to keep engaged with modern technology is to continue to learn. And as such, I think education shifts towards a lifelong learning. And individual companies like Amazon and like probably all the other larger technology companies that rely on technology will be doing the education themselves, assisted by these large language models. Yeah, where sort of this knowledge base out of the code can be extracted from and taught to individuals. AI doesn't get frustrated if you ask it 10 times. Actually, there's a very interesting, and it's pre-large language models as well. In the early days of Alexa, Alexa is our voice assistant, I ran into a blog of a person that had the onset of dementia. And he was really keeping sort of his deterioration. He was writing about that. And one of the things that he was most frustrated about was, or that he was most worried about, is that his caregivers would get frustrated because he would ask him the same thing over and over and over. What day is it today? What day is it today? And so his major revelation was, now I've got Alexa, and Alexa doesn't get angry at me. I can ask it 10 times the same thing, and it will be happy to give me the right information. And that's sort of the power of this technology that has a true human interface and connection.
If you've seen one of Amazon CTO Werner Vogel's keynotes, you know I had to get the inside story about the t-shirts that he wears on stage promoting different bands each year. Plus, we'll talk about an AI project that took him back to his roots. That's coming up after the break.
I wanted a career in IT, but I didn't know where to start. WGU makes it simple. Their accredited online degree programs cover all kinds of IT specialties, and they have valuable industry certifications built in at no extra cost. The payoff? Having those certs back up my degree makes me look even better to future employers. A nonprofit university that includes top industry certs in their programs? I choose WGU. Learn more at wgu.edu/IT certs included.
I look forward to your keynote every year at the AWS reInvent conference in Las Vegas, and I know many other people do. And I want to ask you about one particular part of that keynote. Okay. But first, I want to point out something that's more of a cultural phenomenon that happens behind the scenes, and that is the t-shirt that you wear. Give me the inside story of the t-shirt. This year, it was for a band called Street Sweeper Social Club, which is an American rap rock supergroup.
Yeah, well, they didn't live that terribly long, to be honest. You know, it's Tom Morello and Boots Riley. Basically, they came from, was it Rage Against the Machine, who became Audioslave, and then a few of those went into Street Sweeper Social Club. Didn't last that long because Boots Riley, I think, got ill. To be honest, I hadn't seen them before. I was at South by Southwest a number of years ago. And I was invited to come to Roxy, had a small, from Los Angeles, had a small event somewhere. And these guys were playing there, and they blew my mind away. It was absolutely, totally amazing. I think they didn't last longer than a year or 2 years. Now, the idea about the t-shirt has always been, you know, to have a bit of fun. After all, my keynote is the fourth or the fifth keynote of the whole conference. By that time, our customers are a little bit tired. And I'm no longer doing this high pressure volume. Let's go here, all these launches and things like that. No, it's much more, how should you think about things? How should you think about this year was about cost, for example, or, you know, AI for good. Yeah. But definitely things like cost. Or last year it was think about asynchrony, or the year before. And so it, every time taking big concepts and try to sort of show how this fits into modern software development. So where they don't need to sit there and take notes the whole time. They can lean back a little bit and listen to the story. And I think part of that is not taking yourself too serious. I've always been a t-shirt and jeans guy, so in general. And so that was, I pick every year something that I think will be fun.
But you're not trying to send some underlying message about the keynote through your choice of the band or the project that you feature on a shirt. Okay.
No.
I didn't know if maybe there was
No, actually, yeah, Tom Morello is a very, I'd say, is an activist. I like him. But for example, another year, I had a band called Osdorp Posse, which was a rap band in Dutch out of the 90s. And believe me, nobody in the room knew this band. Someone posted an image of Osdorp Posse is a search term on Google that morning, like completely skyrocketing. Where everybody goes like, what?
What is this?
More amazing is one of the four founding members of that band was in the audience.
Oh, wow.
He had become a software developer, and he was in the audience, and he literally says, I fell on my chair. The Amazon CTO walks on stage with the name of our band on it.
Wow, yeah. That's amazing.
And so it's also been every time something like, try to tell people something new. Go listen to this band because I thought it was a great band, or there's some history there. If there is a link between the different t-shirts, it is because I feel that those that I've promoted have been innovators in their type of music. Street Sweeper Social Club definitely was that, where Tom Morello actually learned, and there's actually a great, I won't tell you, it's a podcast, but there's this 1 hour thing on, I've seen it on Audible, where there's an hour where he tells his story and combines that a little bit with the music. So his whole history. And he actually wanted to become an artist, but he wasn't actually that great a guitar player. And so he tried to change his guitar into an art piece where he started making noises and sounds with it that he never did before. And as such, I think I've always looked for bands that were sort of like on the edge of innovation, whether it's Nine Inch Nails or, I mean, Nirvana, after all, we are from Seattle. I picked in the beginning a number of Seattle bands. After all, Foo Fighters, I think, is currently the most amazing rock band, live rock band ever.
And they're so practically the Amazon house band, given Andy Jassy's fandom of them.
And also, I'm Dutch, so there's also always been a relationship between sort of the DJ that plays at the AWS party on the first evening after my keynote, everybody needs to party.
At the keynote this past year, you shared a story of revisiting your roots in radiology, and I was really struck by this. It was a project where you went back into the field that you got your start in, and you looked for ways to apply machine learning, artificial intelligence, in a very discrete, finite way to make an impact. Tell the story of what you were able to do.
Well, let me start off with this. I mean, after all, I said, you know, artificial intelligence is 25 years old. Yeah, McCarthy, one of the founding fathers of artificial intelligence, says, as soon as it works, we don't call it AI anymore. Yeah, and so it's either image recognition or image processing or text-to-speech or whatever we call it. We don't call it this magic artificial intelligence. It's just something that really works. And one of the things is that I wanted to, in this era where artificial intelligence get this sort of mystic kind of thing around it, that there's a very large body of artificial intelligence technology that doesn't require large language models, that doesn't require the new technology that really worked well on technologies before this. And so I took that on myself as an example to see, can I, as, you know, I'm not a high-end developer, yeah, but I still can get my hands dirty. Can I actually build something that is a very unique application, but that I can actually build. And indeed, you know, when maybe tell a little bit about my own history there. When I came out of high school, first of all, there were no computers when I grew up. And the first time I could actually expose to technology was when I had to go into military service. That was mandatory in the Netherlands in those days. So I spent 2 years in the Navy, and it was the first time I got confronted with technology. And I enjoyed it, absolutely. But also a bit of a social feeling kind of guy. So when I came out of military service, I had to figure out what to do. So I picked something that had healthcare and technology at the same time. So radiology first, so radio diagnostics, and later on radiotherapy in the Dutch National Cancer Research Institute. And one of my mentors there, one of the radiologists, at some moment, and I really enjoyed the tech side of it, but also the human side, both. And one of the radiologists at some moment says, you know what, you should get into technology because you can make way more impact on the world by actually building new technologies that can support healthcare than you staying on as just as a radiologist here. Okay, I was 28, I went back to college, did that, turned out to have a gift for it. Didn't expect that. I still have a very deep connection with that particular part of healthcare. Or I understand healthcare probably better, or healthcare institutions better than other people, and technology there, because I've grown up into it. So I picked one particular problem. And actually not that long before that, I'd visited a hospital in Tala, in just outside Dublin. And one of the problems that this neurosurgeon explained to me, that for people with a stroke, immediate action is every minute X million neurons die. And so taking very fast action is crucial. Now, most of these people come in with complaints. They're being put in a CAT scan or in an MRI scan. And can we build a system that actually, on each of those images, does the test, is a stroke present? And then immediately basically texts the neurosurgeon to come to the hospital. And he says, I'd rather come at 3 o'clock in the morning to the hospital for a false alarm than having to miss one. And so I thought, well, that doesn't sound too hard. Turns out there is a massive data set out there on Kaggle with hemorrhage, brain hemorrhaging. And you could train them to build a model where if you now put a new scan in there, it actually decides whether or not to call the radiologist or may give it priority in terms of reviewing. It actually works. Yeah, and it's not that terribly hard. And there's so many of these problems where you do not need this 700 billion token model that needs massive capacity to run. These ones you can build in a very sustainable manner. And that's important because, first of all, hospitals don't have that terribly much money. And each radiology brain scan needs to go through this system. So making it as simple as possible and as crucial as possible and as fast as possible, while keeping cost absolutely low, showed that we can do this with AI technologies from the past. Yeah,
that's right. It's sort of old-fashioned AI, as you might call it.
Yeah.
This is not ChatGPT. This is machine learning, pattern recognition.
Total.
The people come in, they get scanned, and it recognizes the signs of a hemorrhage on that scan and texts the radiologist, you need to come in and...
Or in this case, the neurosurgeon needs to come in because he's the one that actually operates on this. And there's recently been a whole range of these reports of the role that, let's say, old-fashioned artificial intelligence actually does really well. For example, in Sweden... Just like in quite a few of the other countries in Western Europe, there's a public program for breast cancer detection. Basically, women can go and get a mammogram every 2 years free of charge. That means that the radiologists there basically look at thousands of mammograms a day. And at the end of the day, your eyes aren't that good anymore.
Right.
Turns out we can build image recognition software that does this, that finds 30% more cancers than a single radiologist. And it can find as many as two individual radiologists looking at the same picture. So, and there's a ton of this research that is happening at the moment where I think healthcare, it won't replace the doctors, it won't replace the radiologists, but it becomes their assistants. And it allows them to also take a sort of a 360 look into it. And still modern AI, the Gen AI, can work in this because that has much more of an exploratory sense, but it will bring in agents that are uniquely based for let's take a look at whether there's any, you know, maybe brain hemorrhages or maybe brain tumors. And that may be a very different agent that is being pulled in.
You are big on the potential for AI for good. Is healthcare the place where AI has the biggest potential for good? Would you call out the environment? Give us a sense for what is most promising and exciting to you in this realm.
Well, I think first and foremost, I think if we look at sort of big problems, I think we should look at sort of the sustainability goals that the UN has put out. And I think there's about 25 different ones. After all, you know, our world population, I think by 2050, we'll have an additional 2 billion people. How are you going to feed them? How are we going to make them sure that they have a sustainable economic future? You know, how can we make sure that all of these people get a level of healthcare that they deserve? And so I honestly believe that, you know, while in the Western world where we have very solid healthcare, we'll have lots of tools that will help there. But I think the very important part is whether healthcare in, for example, sub-Saharan Africa is taking place. Now, how does AI play a role there? Well, because in most remote locations, there are no laboratories and there is no places for getting vaccination and things like that. So a company called Swoop Aero, for example, built autonomous drones that will bring vaccines to most remote area, pick up lab material and bring it back. And I think, you know, a number of years ago, the first baby was vaccinated with a vaccine delivered by a drone. And so those are not necessarily, doesn't look like it solves the healthcare problem, but it solves, for example, the infrastructure problem. If you mention the environment, now if you look at, for example, something like Tech Africa, which is basically all the satellite imagery of Africa over a number of years that has access through that particular public program. And for example, in Zimbabwe, they're looking for illegal mining. So are roads being built suddenly in areas where there shouldn't be roads? Yeah? Or mangrove depletion or whatever, things where you can actually keep a look on society. I actually, before we got into this whole AI area, I became really fascinated with especially younger businesses that are willing to solve these very hard human problems. And so we did this video series available on Amazon Prime and in YouTube and on AWS and on my personal website called Now Go Build. And that started off because when I, in my travels around the world, I started to meet a certain set of younger businesses that were not interested in becoming unicorns. They were interested in solving really hard problems and have a good business at the same time. Yeah, but not to become billionaires immediately. One of my most favorite episodes is still the first one. It's a company called Hara in Jakarta in Indonesia. In Indonesia, most smallholder farmers that are actually responsible for creating for growing most of the rice in the world, they don't have an identity. So they can't go to a bank to get a loan. They have to go to a loan shark. Say it's 50% interest. So half of their yield of that piece of land has already gone to this loan shark. So how I created a system where they can measure the plot of land to give the person an identity, measure plot of land, measure yield. That information, every bank, every government institution in Indonesia want access to that. Why? Because repayment of those loans is 100%. Banks don't really want that. And so Hara doesn't make his money by sort of charging the farmers. No, it charges the banks and the other institutions that want access to that data. So creating data for good is a very important path there. And the reason why these people were actually doing this is because they were sons and daughters of smallholder farmers themselves. They were urgently aware of the problem that there is. Now, how do we grow protein enough for a next generation of individuals? You know, we can't continue to grow, let's say, cows, because first of all, it's a very inefficient way of creating protein. You need 7 kilo of feed to create 1 kilo of protein for cattle. Fish, however, 1 kilo of fish food, 1 kilo of fish. And so, for example, it's a company called Aquabyte. It has these massive pens, 200,000 salmon in them. Using AI in that particular case to track the growth of each of the individual 200,000 salmon, they almost named them. But they also look at for disease growth, for all these other things. And so they use AI technology there to help healthily grow more protein. And so, and whether it is healthcare in Brazil, whether it's conservation in South Africa, we've seen all of these companies that are doing really amazing, cool stuff.
But what about the environmental toll of the massive data centers that make AI possible? That's coming up next.
This GeekWire podcast is sponsored in part by Yale University Press. Are you concerned about the rise of AI and how it will impact our society? Every day, artificial intelligence presents us with urgent ethical challenges. How do we harness this extraordinary technology to empower rather than oppress? Nigel Shadbolt and Roger Hampson have written a how-to for building ethical machine intelligence. Their new book, As If Human, Ethics in Artificial Intelligence, is now available wherever books are sold.
It strikes me, just as we're sitting here talking about AI and the climate and the potential to do good, there are also trade-offs in terms of energy consumption, data centers, the footprint that's required to run these GPUs. How do you reconcile those things in your own mind?
Well, it's as always, you know, we need to be very conscious about this. First of all, on our side, on the AWS side, who provides infrastructure for this trading and things like that, it is important that we are as efficient as possible in that. But that's something that has nothing to do with AI. You know, we've gone through 20 years of, now, how far are we? 17 years, I think, with AWS. And before that, for Amazon, the retailer, building data centers is something that's in our blood. And also innovating in that space. For example, in the past, most data centers actually had off-the-shelf servers on them. An off-the-shelf server has a transformer on it that takes 220 AC or 110 AC and then turns that into DC. Now, into your data center, power comes in as DC. So what you have to do, you have to transform from DC to AC because the stupid servers have a transformer on it that requires AC. You lose 30% of your energy in doing that process. So bringing DC, for example, directly to the server boards, no longer have these transformers on them, only have a few steps down, actually saves you 30% of energy. And so it is our task to also, you know, create more, better, more energy efficient servers. And we even have gone to the point that we do that at the CPU level. Yeah, where, you know, yes, you can have a whole variety of CPUs, but if you go to the Graviton ones, there are ARM-based processors, you know, you can easily get 30 to 40% knockoff of your energy usage. So that's significant. The same goes for training and inference of these models. So the whole AI consists of two parts, training, and especially for these large language models, even on very large clusters, that they can take months. Yeah. And then there's inference. How do you run these models? Now, if you want to run them on GPUs, they tend to be extremely power hungry because they're general purpose GPUs, meaning that they can also still do graphics where they were originally built for. So we started asking ourselves, can we build chips that do uniquely that one thing really well, not necessarily being a general purpose GPU, but just being a general purpose trainer? So our Trainium chips do that. And the same goes for inference. The other thing is that we want to make sure with Bedrock, for example, that we give access to a whole variety of different models. We are all about democratization of access to this technology, which is, if we talk about sort of other places in the world, it's equally important that not just the Western world is dependent on, can use this technology, but everyone is should have access to this. Now, by giving many different models, access to many different models, customers can make choices because they know that with this particular model, if it's larger, it will be more energy efficient. So the trade-off between cost, energy, and results, quality of results, is something that customers want to experiment with. Maybe a much smaller model for this particular problem that you try to solve may be the right one. And, of course, you don't need to retrain. You can sort of fine-tune the model with your private data, which means you don't need to rebuild the underlying model. That's why they're called foundational models, and only train with that part on top. So I also believe that there is still a lot of work to be done in terms of trying to understand which models are best for which particular problem. The thing with climate and energy and sustainability is that a few years ago, I started asking quite a few of my customers, so do you have to report about sustainability to the board? And they said, yeah. And CIOs would say, yeah, that's true, but where I'm getting most requests from is for my engineers. Newer generation of engineers are willing, for example, to take, and I heard that story just a few days ago, are willing to take 15 to 20% in a pay cut if they can go work for a company that has sustainability as sort of as a high priority for the digital systems that they're building. And even some companies, I think I used in my keynote this year in reInvent, the company called WeTransfer. So WeTransfer literally has converted their business model into being a sustainable business. And they have all sort of really funny or fun, interesting engineering tricks to actually truly optimize the service to their customers, but at the same time be able to reduce their energy usage significantly. Now, I believe we as cloud providers, and I see this say this as a general purpose, not just for AWS, we need to get to the point where we not only report on cost, but actually report on milligram CO2 used by your particular service for this particular period of time. And I think that's, we're not that terribly far from there. That will definitely happen. And then engineers can start to experiment saying, oh, this is a more energy efficient solution. Now, in general, at this moment, I think given that the amount of resources that you've used in general with a pay-as-you-go model means you paid more if you use more resources. So cost is already a pretty good proxy for sustainability. But we really need to start measuring this, or we are already measuring it, but we need to present it in a way to our customers that is true and accurate in a way that they can also use it towards their regulatory agencies, for example.
You focus each year in your predictions on the upcoming year. We're already 3 months or so into 2024. This year, for 2024, you wrote about AI's cultural awareness, the rise of technology for women's health, AI assistance in software development, and the evolution of education, some of which we've talked about here. What's on your mind as we're into the middle of the year? Can you give us a little bit of a preview of what might be in your realm of thinking for 2025?
I could, but then I'd have to kill you.
Maybe I could be one of those skits.
More importantly is, I think, looking at, I tend to do look back at sort of, was I right or not?
Right.
Yeah. And in general, I was right. I wasn't always right about the timescale. But for example, the first 3 months of this year, investment in femtech has, for example, exploded.
Which was one of your predictions.
I don't know whether that's purely of me. I think it was a pattern that I already saw happening over some time. So we already are seeing sort of enough evidence. Definitely software development is changing dramatically. Culturally aware. It has triggered a number of very interesting things. For example, our Japan team just did with a whole range of our customers, did a hackathon and built as many of these culturally aware Japanese models. And so I think they created 12 different models. And so these models can compete with each other and talk to each other in sort of agreeing on what the answer should be. You know, after all, and it's the example I give most, Isabella Allende is a very famous author from South America, daughter of the old former president of Chile. If you ask for a Western-trained large language model to give a review or a summary of Isabel Allende's book, you get a very different answer from a South American one. And as such, I believe, and we see, for example, tremendous interest in building these unique models. The Falcon model from the UAE is the biggest open source, best performance open source model, but it's trained in Abu Dhabi and on the AWS region in the UAE. It's really there that we see that, you know, there is significant traction for almost every one of these predictions already. So I think I did well this year. What I'm going to do next year, you'll have to wait for that.
Are there any concluding words here that you want to leave people with?
Well, you know what? I think we as technologists, I mean, we talk a lot about technology and good use and bad use of technology and things like that. You know, we as technologists also have the responsibility to make sure that our technology is used responsibly, or that there are tools next to this technology where we can investigate whether it's being used correctly. And there are a number of serious problems in the world where technology can be applied to. I think FORN is, for example, one of these organizations that look at sort of sexual trafficking of young people. And use technology to, on one hand, discover them, where they're being kept. On the other hand, avoiding, for example, that sexually exploitive material ends up on your servers. Or they now also have a system, for example, that if you look at sort of the interaction on social media, where they can indicate this is a grooming pattern that is happening. Now, these are significant, serious problems in this world. We as technologists have the responsibility, because we introduced this technology in the first place, to also make sure that we can use this responsibly in a technology way. So, as always, good work requires good data. And I think one of the more important things is that we need to make sure that we have these large data sets available for everyone to use. Because, you know, AI, without good data, we don't do good AI. Good AI requires good data. Good work requires good people. And we as technologists should be stepping in there to do the right thing for this planet.
Werner Vogels, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure, Todd.
Werner Vogels is Chief Technology Officer at Amazon. See the show notes for links to the various subjects we discussed, including his AWS reInvent keynote and his tech predictions for 2024. Thanks for listening. Kurt Milton edited this episode. I'm GeekWire co-founder Todd Bishop. We'll be back next week with a new episode of the GeekWire podcast.